Good evening and welcome behind the news for July 22nd, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics and a very broad definition of those things tonight, at least for the first segment. Well, we'll be talking with Judith Levine, author of a new memoir called Do You Remember Me? A Father, a Daughter, and the Search for the Self, which is a memoir of her experiences of her father's Alzheimer's disease and also a reflection on mind and self and identity and family and all those things that that disease really brings to the forefront. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Ian Williams, author of a new book called Deserter, about George Bush's splendid military career. And since Ian is also a veteran UN correspondent, I think I'll ask him what the deserters' foreign policies have done to life at the UN, too. But the main focus is that book, Deserter, the illustrious military career of George Bush, just out from Nation Books. And a few announcements and some headlines before we get to the main portion of the program. About a month, or a little over a month from now, the weekend just before the Republicans come to town, that is Friday, August 20th, Saturday, the 21st, and Sunday, the 22nd, there's going to be a Life After Capitalism conference. I'll be speaking at it on Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. But Friday evening, there will be a plenary called Beyond Bush, an evening of visionary resistance, featuring Naomi Klein, Vijay Prashad, Michael Albert, and Robin Kelly. And then Saturday, a bunch of smaller sessions. I'll be speaking at the Contours of Capitalism about recent economic events. Who knows what I'll be saying? It's so far away, 5 weeks. The afternoon, there'll be a panel on perspectives on power, and then on Sunday, Envisioning Another World. For more information, this will actually, at the CUNY Grad Center at 5th Avenue and 34th Street. Again, that's the weekend just before the Republican Convention, the 20th through the 22nd. And for more information, you can see their website, Life After Capitalism, all one word, lifeaftercapitalism.org, a very optimistic URL, assuming that such a thing can exist. And now turning to matters of actually existing capitalism, the world we live in right now, some of the recent economic releases and what's going on, particularly with the U.S. economy. It was reported this morning with the Conference Board's measure of leading economic indicators, a package of economic statistics that's designed to foretell changes in the U.S. economy several months down the road. Fell in the month of June by 0.2%, a bit more than most people were expecting. The index has been in a generally weakening trend over the last several months. Some of you may recall that we had done the purveyor of another leading index, from the Economic Cycles Research Institute. We had its research director, Lakshman Achuthan, on the other week talking about his leading index, which is actually produced every week rather than every month, like the Conference Board Index, and with a much shorter delay. And it claims, with much more accuracy, the weekly leading index was devised by the same person who devised the predecessor of the Conference Board's leading index, Jeffrey Moore, who died several years ago. Moore, one of the great gurus of business cycle research, created the weekly index because he thought the monthly one was too slow and too infrequent for real-time economic analysis. That one is looking a little weaker than the Conference Board one, as you heard Lakshman Achuthan say here a couple of weeks ago. He thought it portended a slowdown in the U.S. economy in the coming months, so we'll see if that happens. Now the Conference Board leading index heading into the negative territory, though. So we'll see if this if the indexes have any soothsaying value as they have in the past. This will all come clear in the coming months. This morning also released the tally of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, the so-called initial claims series, which is one of the most widely followed by Wall Street and other people who follow these sorts of things. The initial claims number fell by 11,000 this week after rising 41,000 the previous week. There's some very strange seasonal adjustment problems with this index because of it's a time of year when auto plants close for a couple of weeks to retool for the new model year, so it's very hard to isolate what's just that normal pattern of closure and separate that from what's going on in the broader economy. So some mixed readings out of this index the last couple of weeks. It had a very strong reading and a very weak reading, and now it's sort of moderately improving reading in the latest week. So we'll see what's going on with that. But it does, in general, portend a reasonably healthy job market. Nothing booming, but certainly not not going back into the jobless recovery of last year. So. Well, we may not see the kinds of very rapid job gains we saw in March, April, and May in the coming months. It's also not likely we're going to see the zeros or negative numbers that we saw in the months before that. And also, yesterday, released the ABC News Money Magazine weekly measure of consumer sentiment. That was unchanged in a week, consumer attitudes took a very, very sharp decline in the early part of the year, recovered from roughly February into May, and then took a steep dive in May and into mid-June, and then have recovered since. So quite a roller coaster ride. So now the consumers seem to be feeling somewhat better about their own personal finances and also the state of the U.S. economy. These numbers are consistent with a reasonably healthy economy, but again, no raving boom, and we'll see if that translates into actual purchasing, which is, of course, what keeps this economy going, buying of lots of stuff, not all of which is urgently needed. But anyway, that's what keeps the American wheel of consumption turning, turning, turning. And although there's not always a close relation between how people say they feel and what they actually do. Some signs of softening in the housing market, which has been very, very, very hot for the last couple of years. There was no recession at all in housing. Usually that is a sector that takes a steep dive when the rest of the economy does. But that didn't happen this time because of the very, very low interest rates prompted by the Federal Reserve's efforts to keep the economy from imploding. Those low interest rates encourage people to buy new houses or to extract the appreciated equity value of their existing houses. So real boom time in the housing markets for a couple of years, and now that seems to be slowing a bit. The National Association of Home Builders, who put out a monthly index of the state of the housing market, that was off a point in July from 68 to 67. Anything above 50 is a strong reading, so 67 is pretty respectable, but off the highs of late last year when it was over 70. And also the Mortgage Bankers Association's tally of applications for new mortgages fell in the latest week, the week ending July 16. And also their measure of applications for refinancing, which has been one of the great motors of the U.S. economy over the last two or three years, people who have been refinancing their existing mortgages and very often taking out some fresh cash as they do, using the house as an ATM. That's been keeping consumption going. Injected about $600 or $700 billion worth of buying power into the economy last year, but that's slowing down. The tax cuts are slowing down. So what we need is some serious job growth, and even some serious wage growth, which we've not been seeing. And Alan Greenspan, in testimony before Congress 2 days ago, noted that the polarization in incomes, this has been a very, very good couple of years for corporate profits and for very rich people. For everyone else, it's been more a matter of scraping by. Alan Greenspan, of all people, who is not known for being concerned about the workings of the market or the status quo, Alan Greenspan said this kind of polarization is a threat to our democratic society. Not, of course, that he's prepared to do anything about it, but it's interesting that Alan Greenspan is paying it some notice. And then abroad, some of our neighbors to the south, it was released over the last couple of days that the employment situation in Mexico weakened. The unemployment rate now up for two consecutive months. It was down sharply into late last year and then rose in the early part of this year. So Mexican labor market not doing so well, which is kind of strange because if the U.S. economy is supposedly in recovery or expansion mode, Mexico should be coming along for the ride, but it doesn't quite seem to be. And then Brazil, however, showing improved situation in their job market. The unemployment rate declined again. It's also for the second consecutive month. Further signs that the Brazilian economy seems to be recovering. So we'll have a closer look at what's been going on there sometime in the next several weeks. Brazil, an important and interesting country with a government that's supposedly supposed to be at least left of center, but has been behaving very IMF and market friendly. And some people say this is all part of the long-term strategies. Other people say it's all a sellout. We should take a look and see what the truth of the situation is. Okay, enough of the news headlines, and now we're going to travel on what is not exactly a beaten path through this program, but an important and interesting detour, I think. We'll talk with the author Judith Levine, who has written a new book called Do You Remember Me? A Father, a Daughter, and the Search for the Self, just published by the Free Press. Welcome to WBAI, Judith.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. So your book is partly a memoir, but also partly a meditation on how we think about self and mind and family and social relations. So it's kind of hard to figure out exactly where to get started. But why don't you just lay out what the situation with your father was and how you got the idea of writing the book.
Well, my book traces mostly the last 2 years, but about the last 10 years of my father's life and my family's life. My father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 1992, and then we, like many thousands of other families, not only families with demented parents, but just elderly parents, had to figure out how to relate to him, what to do for him, how to care for him. So we were faced with the whole array of social and economic and personal challenges that all that throws in front of you. So I wanted to write the book for a few reasons. I had a bad relationship with my father and was interested in trying to work out something before he disappeared altogether. And of course, I, like everyone else, was facing my own mortality, and I didn't want to go there with terror or denial, which seem to be the only two options that our culture offers us.
And there's, well, how much social support is there for people who have to deal with a family member with dementia?
Well, there's not all that much. There is the Alzheimer's Association, which runs some support groups and has clinical trials of this and that drug. I might add that this and that drug, the four or five drugs that are now available, have recently been revealed to do practically nothing for people with memory loss, and yet almost all money for the disease is going into biomedical research. So that said, there is really virtually no policy, no government support, and hardly any social support except a kind of threadbare patchwork for people taking care of family members with dementia, or I would add, taking care of family members with any disability or family members who are aging.
And how did your family manage it? You had quite a juggling of personnel to see that your father was taken care of.
Well, we did. And, you know, my parents were lucky to have come up during the years when middle-class do-good professions gave them pensions and good health benefits in their retirement. And so they are relatively well off compared to many, many other families. And so we now have a full-time, 24-hour caregiving staff for my father. My mother is living with her new partner, and my father has one woman who takes care of him during the weekdays and a guy who comes on the weekends. Plus, he goes to a Veterans Affairs financed daycare center, which he gets 1 year of, and when that's over, I don't know what's going to happen. So my parents are patching it together with a little bit of Medicare, lots of savings, and many, many free hours, of course, until this new little constellation of caregivers was mobilized. My mother was taking care of my father 24/7.
And, well, all caregivers face an awful complex, awfully complex set of emotions. Could you describe what that's like? I mean, the kinds of rage and resentment and guilt and tenderness and all that mixed up.
Well, that's what the whole book is kind of about. And the story of Alzheimer's that we hear is that when the person loses his brain cells, he loses his self, and he is therefore less and less of a person, in a certain way, kind of an empty vessel, or, you know, a body that needs to be moved around. Or he's a vessel of this deteriorating brain, which makes him act in all kinds of bizarre ways. This is, I think, the wrong story. people's selves are created socially. They're born in relationship and in community and history, and therefore they are sustained in the same way. And so we are faced with having to, I think, find the self of the person and then react to it and try to, you know, sort of do the best we can to interpret what's going on with that person. All of that said, you know, illness and crisis and difficulty can tear apart even the strongest families, and my family is no stronger than any, and it's got all of its, you know, mishigas, all of its conflicts. And so I think this situation has really sort of torn asunder, you know, many of the sort of torn asunder our family. My mother and I have had lots of conflict about what's happening to my dad and how we can deal with him. I have sort of been moving closer to him while she's been moving away from him. And, you know, I don't think this is peculiar to our family. However, again, the sort of standard story is there's the loved one, and everyone loves the loved one, and whatever the family believes is good for the loved one will be good for the loved one. But as a matter of fact, just as when families are younger, there's a great deal of conflict inside of the family. Therefore, it's not always the best thing to leave it to the family to take care of a person.
I'm speaking with Judith Levine, author of Do You Remember Me? A Father, a Daughter, and the Search for the Self, just published by Free Press. You write in several passages in the book with some skepticism about the purely medical model of Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, there's a tendency in our society to think that an awful lot, and more things are explained this way, an awful lot of behavior and thought is determined by genetics and cell structures and things like that. You're a little skeptical of these explanations.
The thing that you're talking about is a big process which has been called the medicalization of aging, and there's the medicalization of sexuality. You know, we are now led to believe that shyness is, you know, has something to do with your brain, and gayness has something to do with your hormones or your brain or your DNA, whatever it is. And the response to that, both a cause and an effect of this way of looking at human life, is that more and more we see our lives as engineering problems to be solved in a scientific and biomedical way. This is very convenient for the medical industry because there's an enormous amount of money to be made in pharmaceutical so-called cures for all of those aspects of human life that were once considered anything from eccentricity to fate. So we now have these drugs for dementia, and about 90% of the National Institute on Aging's money goes to biomedical research, and there's millions and millions of dollars coming out of it for pharmaceutical companies. But we neglect what I said before, which is that we are socially created human beings, that I would say just about everything about us culturally and socially is not biological. It is created by history and by culture. And so this medical response to curing, you might say, mortality, really goes hand in glove with our cultural notion that each person is an island, each person is an individual bodily organism which needs to sort of fend for itself. And, you know, in reality, that's not what life is like for anyone. As human beings, we are not autonomous. We need to take care of each other. We need communities. We need families. We need government. And I think that these environmental and social changes would probably do a lot better for people with dementia, and I'd say for all of us, than trying to cure the you know, the inevitable changes that happen to us as we age.
And you also suggest in some places that even the course of the dementia itself is affected by the social environment.
That's right. Yeah. There's been some really interesting research by people who have critiqued the medicalization of aging and have a more social constructionist view of aging, and therefore they also have a way of treating dementia that has much more to do with social stimulation, music, art, creating democratic institutions where people actually feel that they have some say in what happens to them. And there have been actual brain changes observed in these people who have regained intellectual and social functioning that were thought to be irrevocably lost. One of the most influential psychologists in this area is an English guy named Tom Kitwood, recently deceased, and he referred to this process of regaining intellectual function as rementia.
You also mentioned a rather famous study of nuns, which showed several things, among them that the brain changes didn't always result in the same kinds of symptoms. What was that about?
Yeah, Dr. David Snowden did a long and large longitudinal study, of nuns who were a great subject pool because they all lived more or less the same lives. And what he did was he looked at their histories, at their childhoods and earlier adulthoods, and then he followed them into old age for 20 years. And what he saw was that even though many people, many of these nuns, when they died, had the characteristic plaques and tangles in the brain that are the symptomology, the brain symptomology of Alzheimer's disease, some of them became demented and others did not become demented. And what he hypothesized and I think showed in this study was that their social environments, their earlier education, the use of their minds, rewarding work, other physical health aspects such as exercise and good nutrition, all of these things contributed to whether one became demented or not. And what he said was that health is not just a matter of the biological body. It is a matter of how we live in communities.
And, of course, the American way of dealing with these matters is just about the wrong kind of thing to do in the light of that kind of finding.
Well, you know, we in America, probably more than anywhere else on the globe, value autonomy and productivity above all else. And, you know, like it or not, the older you get, the less autonomous you are and the less productive you are. You could also say when you're little, you're not too autonomous and you're not too productive. We're not too good at taking care of little kids either. And so what we do is we blame people for their own dependence. We are ashamed of our dependence and fearful of our dependence. And this is just really contrary to the ways that almost every other people on the earth think about who we are and the responsibilities we have toward each other. And I'd say the third thing that we value very highly, not just Americans but Europeans altogether, is rationality. You know, the famous Cartesian cogito, I think, therefore I am, leads us to believe that when we cease to be able to think rationally, we are not, or maybe we deserve not to be.
But also, those of us socializing in that kind of atmosphere find it very difficult often to deal with people who are losing control of that cogito.
We do, and, you know, there's a reason why Alzheimer's was dubbed the disease of the century and why we fear it more than anything else. And that is because we cannot imagine what life might be like for someone who doesn't have rational functioning. But one of the things that's been really interesting and I think for me somewhat consoling about spending more time with my father is that I see that once he got past the point of being frustrated and angry and fearful at the losses that he could feel in himself, once he got past that point, he's actually been happier than he was before. I mean, he doesn't have the anxieties. He doesn't have the regrets. He doesn't have the anticipation that he had of things before. And so he has achieved this state of mind that Buddhists and other meditators are constantly questing toward, and that is he lives in the present moment at all times.
And in the course of this, your mother met another man at, was it a support group?
Yes, she met a man at an Alzheimer's support group, and when his wife died, he began to court her, and pretty soon, very soon, they were in a deep, intimate relationship, and not long after that, she moved out to live with him. And my reaction to this was, let's say I was not enthusiastic about it. You know, everyone said to me, oh, that's wonderful, lucky her, and now I think come around to seeing that it's great that my mother can be happy in these last years of her life. But it was also scary and hurtful, just like a 10-year-old watching her parents get divorced. And the other thing was that my family is one that values rationality, intellect very, very highly. And if I worried that not being smart might lose me the approval and love of my family, it seemed to me that this was proof that now that my father had lost his ability to be smart, he was losing the love of his wife. And so that was a sort of terrifying time for me. And I think I reacted quite angrily toward my mother.
And I've only got like a minute left, but if you had a large budget and unlimited powers of social engineering, I mean, what would be the way to deal with Alzheimer's?
I take the $200 billion or so that we're spending preemptively destroying other countries and put it into home care, community care, a real integration of people with dementia into communities instead of segregating them, and doing everything we can to make life stimulating, kind, compassionate, environmentally healthy for not only the aged but for everyone else in need.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Judith Levine. Judith Levine is the author of Do You Remember Me? A Father, a Daughter, and a Search for Self, a very thoughtful and moving book, just published by the Free Press. And we'll be back in a moment after this little break.
It begins here for me on this road. How the whole mess happened, I don't know. But I know it couldn't happen again in a million years.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi. Hi-Fi. WBAI, 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
And we're back here on Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at economics and politics, and we'll be back after a little musical break from Johnny Thunders to talk about the illustrious military career of President George W. Bush. And That was Johnny Thunders from many years ago. You Can't Put Your Arms Around a Memory. And unfortunately, our guest isn't here yet, so we're going to have to improvise. Do you have a little something you can play there, Michael, while we can conspire?
Yeah, just give me a second.
All right.
I'll come up with that in just a moment.
And,
got right here.
All right. Let's see.
Hey, this is Smokey Robinson, and you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York.
Let the music take your mind.
And the gods of timing have finally smiled on us. Ian Williams has arrived. And Ian Williams is the author of a new book called Deserter. And sadly, I forgot to bring my copy along with me, so I can't give you the bibliographic information. Published by Nation Books, right?
Indeed.
And written in with blazing speed, but at no sacrifice of quality.
Oh, the quality is always enhanced, I find, when you work into a tight deadline.
So I think most of us know that George W. Bush has had a less than illustrious military career, but what were you able to find out about, he donned his outfit to proclaim triumph in Iraq over a little year ago, but that's the high point of his military career, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you say everybody, and the problem is you, me, and sort of listeners to WBAI, but out there there's a lot of people who think of him as a regular veteran who sort of served his country. He's managed to really pull off a spectacular con trick, and flight onto the deck of USS Abraham Lincoln in his flight suit, which, as far as I could tell, had a padded codpiece.
Yeah, it looked like he was packing there.
Yeah. So he was. This was the culmination of a whole era in which I think something like one third of his speeches, policy speeches, were made on military bases or to military personnel or to veterans.
And that moment, on the flight deck itself, I think, talking to a lot of people, they think that actually happened somewhere in theater, as they say, but it was actually right off the coast of California, right?
It was just off California, and in fact the ship had been held just out of sight of the shores of California to justify him using a jet rather than a helicopter to get there. So he could pretend to fly, because he lost his pilot's license because during his year's absence without leave or desertion in Alabama, he never went for his flight medical. So a lot of people, if you remember, they actually sell dolls with naval aviator George W. Bush. They're sort of, you know, G.I. Joe sort of style dolls. In fact, Jonathan Scheele at the Nation office has one, and we checked it, and it has foam rubber in the crotch. So we're not quite sure whether this is an incontinence pad or an attempt to enhance his virility. But I did get a call from one Californian ex-Air Force colonel who tells me, you know, this problem, he said, it's an organ battle between Junior and George Bush Senior.
Well, George Bush Sr., although there was some talk during the campaign in 92 that he bailed out in his comrades, but he actually did see combat and was regarded by some as having performed heroically. Tell us a little bit more about 41's military career.
Actually, I mean, he did completely the reverse of his son. He was in Andover as well. The day he was eligible, he left school and he used his political pull to get into the Naval Air Force, U.S. Navy Air in the U.S. Navy Aviation Arm. And so he actually used his pull to get into a war. Admittedly, it might have been out of shame that his father was one of the leading Nazi financial collaborators on Wall Street. That's a separate issue. He did do it. He was shot down. He did bail. He put himself in danger. I really don't know whether he sort of left somebody else behind or whatever.
Well, that was Alexander Coburn's theory, so, you know.
Always a theory.
Yes.
So, I mean, he was, I think, in that sense, genuinely heroic. And it's interesting, the contrast was that his son used his political pull to stay out as long as possible. And when the draft was becoming inevitable, at the height of the Tet Offensive, he used his political pull to get into the Texas Air National Guard, a unit which was known locally as Air Canada, because you've got all the benefits of flying north of the border and none of the temperature problems or the political problems that might ensue.
If you consider Texas a comfortable place in any climatological sense. And it was no easy feat to get at the Texas National Guard.
There were 500 people in line, and he flew right over the top, which was about his only qualification for being a jet pilot. When he took his pilot aptitude test in January of that year, he scored 25% on the pilot aptitude test, which I think, I'm not sure, but it was a multiple choice question with four answers. That's what you get for randomly ticking the boxes, isn't it, statistically speaking?
Maybe he just picked number one all the way down.
Yeah, that would get you 25%.
Yeah.
He did get, I think, Billy, I remember it was 85% for officer quality. But I think you ticked the boxes saying, yes, my father is a leading Republican, my grandfather was a senator, you know, I have lots of money, and I'm a heritage student at Yale. That would sort of get him officer quality, I think, right away.
A fellow who used his family ties to great advantage. And what did he do once he got into the Texas Air National Guard?
Well, the second bit, which I've had several military people who've written and reading this book, it's very interesting, the reaction of the military. There are a lot of people thoroughly disgusted with his flying in under false colours. First of all, he was commissioned an officer immediately out of training school. And the only exception, several of these people who called me up told me, were he had to go to ROTC, which he'd never done. He had to go to officer training school, which he didn't do. Or he had to be already a pilot. I had a pilot's license. None of these happened. So he was commissioned an officer in the Texas Air National Guard who then managed to swing this past the Pentagon nationally on a fast track. It seems that he did actually fly in a creditable way and enjoyed himself for 2 years. And then the mysterious bit is, he had several leaves where he canvassed in Florida, he canvassed in Texas for Republicans. Always Republicans of the kind that you often suspected had white hood and gown hanging in the back of their closets.
Really?
Yes.
But that wasn't really the kind of company his father kept. Was he already showing his rightward swerve?
Well, I mean, I think what we actually see in the dynastic history here is the shift in the Republicans nationally. I mean, older Bush was the sort of old East Coast WASP aristocracy. This was sort of a thinly descended line to the party of Abraham Lincoln, you know, with Rockefeller and people could be in the Republicans then. And what happened was once they got down south there, they sort of really teamed up with the most vicious end of the old Southern Democrats, and now you have the people who are now running the Republican Party nationally.
And what was Daddy Bush doing in those days? Was he in Congress then?
He was in oil.
He was in oil.
He was about to be in Congress. He canvassed for his daddy, and he was also, remember, round about then, shortly afterwards, he became head of the CIA, and then he became ambassador to China, the UN, and I think he was chairman of the National Republican Party at one point.
Yeah, when I was in college, I knew a guy who came from Bush's district in Houston. He said, "Watch this guy, George Bush. He's going somewhere." I said, "Yeah, sure. Who is he?" And little did I know.
But I've actually got a soft spot for George Bush Sr. I mean, no, it's not politically correct to say so, but he was the guy who turned round to Ronald Reagan in the primaries and said that accused him of running voodoo economics.
Which some people have said is a slur on voodoo.
Yeah, of course. But, I mean, they've got to have voodoo. That, I'm sorry, Bill Clinton actually got his... He got out them juju dolls and he did voodoo for 8 years.
And so then, after flying his plane around with some mysterious holes in his record, there's this mysterious move to Alabama. What was that all?
Well, he was running on a senatorial campaign as a consultant for Blount. And it's interesting, a lot of the people who are around him now were with him on these campaigns. And, you know, the press officers, the others, I think this is where the Karl Rove Nexus, all of the others came together. So he was on this campaign in Alabama. So to cover this, he got a transfer from the Texas Air National Guard to Alabama. And the Texas Air National Guard, first of all, transferred him to a base where basically he'd turn up once a week, have a cup of coffee and say hello. And then the National Air Guard nationally said, "Excuse me, we don't spend 2 years training a highly expensive pilot so we can go and drink coffee. He's got to go to Danley Base in Alabama," which is the main one. So they changed his orders and sent him there. And the interesting thing is he never turned up to any of these. There's no one person, the commanding officer, Turnip Seed of the base, says he never saw him. And it's not just the people overlooked him. Several of the pilots sort of said, "Well, we were actually looking forward to network with this hotfoot congressman, congressman's son from Texas. And we were looking for him actively, and he never turned up." And the only two records we
have... Didn't the White House find one person who sort of who's claimed to remember him?
What, the White House didn't find him. They pointed the media towards an officer called Calhoun, who said... And the White House is very clever like this. It's right the way through. They're always deniable. They never put their faith and credit behind him, such as it is. They said, you should go and talk to this guy. He's interesting. And the press went and spoke to him, and it was interesting. Very interesting. This guy actually remembered seeing Bush before he was sent to the base on the nights that he wasn't supposed to be doing drill.
A precocious memory.
Yes. So, you know, recovered memory syndrome, and he admits he was a Republican. But it's amazing how many of the media that threw off the scent immediately. I mean, you know, the idea of in any way attacking a president. I mean, that's why we called the book Deserter, because Peter Jennings' sort of spuriously outraged reaction to Michael Moore calling him a deserter. We felt, you know, excuse me, he is. This isn't controversial. It's incontrovertible. He was missing for a year. What more do you want during wartime?
You know, I'm speaking with Ian Williams, veteran correspondent, UN specialist, among other things, and also author of a new book, Deserter. Is there a subtitle to that?
It's called Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Own Past. Which rolls it all up, really.
Yes. Just published by Nation Books, right?
Nation Books, available in every good bookstore or online.
And the Alabama sojourn was also punctuated by a few missing medical examinations.
Well, this was the key bit, was that at one point he has to have, as a pilot, he has to have an annual flight medical. He was ordered to turn up for one in July. He didn't. They then sent him one saying, basically, you know, by failing to turn up for this, you are in dereliction of duty. He's grounded himself. He's made himself unfit for duty. As surely as if he'd sort of blown his big toe off or let a shotgun next to his ear to make himself deaf, he's made himself unfit for duty. And then they said he should report for a flight inquiry, which was an inquiry by his superior officers into why he, quote, failed to accomplish the medical, unquote. He never turned up for a medical. And the White House says, well, he knew that the plane he was being trained to fly was no longer was going to be phased out of service, so he decided it wasn't worthwhile. And I invite you to consider the prospects for a National Guardsman in Iraq who decides that this garrison is about to be phased out, so it wasn't really worth his while going back. You know, I don't think the Commander-in-Chief would take very kindly to this degree of independence on the part of his junior officers.
Well, we've had on this show a fellow who decided not to return to his unit in Iraq and is facing a year in jail now. So for normal people...
Well, in those days, what would have happened to George W. Bush was he would have been drafted and sent to Vietnam. If he'd have been a normal Joe Stick from New Jersey or New York without nepotistic connections, if a failure to turn up for his National Guard duty meant that he would be automatically drafted.
And then recently it was disclosed that some of the records have disappeared.
Well, there's a sort of statistical relationship between disappearance and George Bush records, which is pretty close, like sort of tobacco and lung cancer. Statistically significant.
Still can't find that cause.
Over, yeah.
A Heidegger correlation.
Yeah, and the latest one, in fact, they're not as missing as they think. I mean, but the idea that they should pick up on this particular microfilm spool to attempt an experimental transfer method, you know, did they really think a cigarette lighter on the cellulose was going to help preserve it? But there's a guy called Bolo Buffin, Joseph Nobles, down in Tennessee, and he did better research than most of the press, and he checked the records, and the punch cards not only have the current quarter, they always have the three previous quarters. So he just checked the next quarter, and he found that George W. Bush was down for, I think, 4 non-active duty days, which means he might have made a phone call, he might have signed in Alabama. But in 1 year, from May to May, while he was in Alabama, he did not do one single active duty day, and that's on the records that the White House seems to have overlooked.
As I recall, during the 92 campaign, some SEC records pertaining to Daddy Bush's company disappeared during the campaign. So it seems to be a family habit.
Indeed. <yes. laughs> Berger took them out of the office.
Yes, right. There are a lot of hints of, shall we say, cocaine usage around Bush's failure to report for medical examinations. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, we've got to be fair and balanced. We can't be like Fox. We can simply point out that the White House is on the record as saying George W. Bush has not used any narcotics since 1974. And for some reason, no one's ever asked him about what about before 1974.
They actually said that.
Yes. Yeah. And so there's a big gap.
That's like saying yes, he did between 1968.
Yeah, but there's some failure of logic. I mean, they should get some of Chomsky's book on linguistics. I think about from the political stuff to pass the logic from the White House. One of the things also I include, if you remember, the appendix in the book, because I thought it was just so revelatory about how the White House press office works. Helen Thomas, one of the few sort of vertebrate correspondents left in Washington, it seems at times, said on February the 13th this year, she went and asked Scott McClellan, can you comment, has the president ever had to do community service? So first of all, McClellan sort of acts, oh, there's so many different forms of community service, you know.
1,000 points of light.
Yes, et cetera, et cetera. And, well, he refused to answer. She kept on, said, no, has he been sentenced to mandatory community service as a form of punishment, you know, by criminal activity? And he refused to answer. For half an hour, this guy is sort of wriggling like an impaled octopus, saying, well, why do you want to know this, Ellen? I'm really interested. And, you know, Ellen, you know, well, you know, what particular aspect would you be interested in? And she's saying, well, yes or no. And can you ask the president if you don't have any knowledge? And for half an hour, the guy wriggled. So if you remember the guy who died, who committed suicide, J.R. Hatfield, who wrote a book about this, it's, let us say, it seems a workable hypothesis that at some point he was taken before a sweetheart judge for narcotics possession, and instead of being sent down for 30 years, which, of course, I disapprove of harsh sentences like that, but think of what it would have saved the world.
Well, that's
if George W. Bush had been black and Texan. But then he wouldn't have made president either with this lot. So, but coming back to it, it seems that it's very likely that there's some type of sweetheart deal, because in the following year, he suddenly discovered a huge charitable interest, which no one had ever detected before, and spent 6 months working in a downtown Houston project for underprivileged minorities. You know, and you know, when somebody gets a sort of road to Houston dramatic conversion like this, you know, something's happened. And this was the very period that he was supposed to be doing his National Guard service. He was doing, it would appear, there's a working hypothesis that he was doing community service.
I'm speaking with Ian Williams, author of Deserter, which has too long a subtitle for me to re-encapsulate, just published by Nation Books. And so what about his final separation from the military? What form did that take?
It was as murky as everything else. He came back beginning of May after 1 year. His officers, his superior officers, including his sponsors up till then, wrote in their report that they had no basis to make a report because they hadn't seen this officer for the previous year. And obviously, I think, once again, we're reconstructing, but suddenly he had a huge excess of duty. He was almost full-time for 3 months. And it appears that basically they had told him, hey, you know, we're getting in deep doo-doo because of you. We've covered you as far as we can. You better turn up here. You do 3 months almost continuous, and that will fulfill your active duty quotient for the for your term of duty, and then we will help you with an early release to go to Harvard Business School. And you know, we've been a bit rude about Texas, but we should remember Texas does have some standards. The University of Texas Law School turned George W. Bush down. Harvard Business School accepted him because there was a legacy involved.
God, what a beneficiary of affirmative action he's been. But also in the book, or in the subtitle even, you talk about the war on veterans. What are you talking about there?
Well, while he's been dressing himself in this spurious military garb, and I think I said, you know, he's appeared in uniform more times than any other head of state except Saddam Hussein and Fidel Castro in the last year or two, always with commander in chief.
When he wasn't on vacation.
Yes, but he started a war, and basically he and his administration have been viciously mean to active serving soldiers and veterans. They're trying to cut back on the VA medical system. They're cutting back on base schools. He tried to veto an increase in the death grant to survivors. He tried to veto and hold off free meals for patients in hospital, in military hospitals, war wounded. As you know, they've hidden the statistics on actually how many wounded there are. They tried to hide the dead coming back. He hasn't actually been to a single funeral, as far as I know. None of his Chicken Hawk cabinet have been to a single military funeral. Since they since the war.
Well, they feel it very deeply, but they're just very busy.
Yes, they know they feel the pain, but they don't want to feel it too much, so they stay away. So, I mean, I think Wesley Clark actually put it in a way. I mean, I don't want to give too much credit to the Democrats, but he says, well, you know, Democrats like soldiers and Republicans like military hardware. So they'd much rather pump money to Star Wars, to Halliburton, to contractors than they would to ordinary GIs whose pay is pretty lousy, whose training prospects are pretty bad. And then you've got the final ignominy that all of these poor guys who are working as mailmen or were firemen in various parts of the states are suddenly upped and dropped into Iraq. They didn't have the option, like George W. Bush, to tick a box saying no to overseas service. And now they're there, they've been sort of reverse conscripted. They've had stay orders, stop orders, so that they stop loss orders, they're called. So even if their term of offer, their term in service is due up, they've been extended indefinitely. So they're stuck garrisoning the Gulf with poor equipment. Most of them didn't have body armor. The vehicles they were given weren't armored. You know, basically, they were car bomb fodder.
And as I recall, Clinton's the coverage of Clinton's draft evasion and his lack of a military career and just about every other scandal associated with him was wall to wall. How much coverage has the Bush military history gotten?
It's interesting. It's been scattered. I mean, most of what I could find was on the public record. The interesting bit was putting it together, which no one seemed to have done from beginning to end in the same, in a sort of same comprehensive way. He's what he'd been doing, first of all, in Texas, nobody brought it up because, for example, Lloyd Benson's son was in the same unit. The Democrats were all in the same game, you know, with Dan Quayle and the others. I think seven of the Oilers team were in the same unit as him. This was a favored this was a favored way out for favored people.
Air Canada.
Yes, Air Canada, a champagne unit. That was the other subtitle for it. So there was no sort of partisan thing in Texas that really brought this up. And then when he brought it up on Clinton, they ran and ran with it. And then I think they realized, hey, we got away with this. Let's carry on. And I think the most sickening sign of all of this was, you know, he was not sort of one of the great liberals by any means, but when Senator Max Cleland was toppled on the grounds of lack of patriotism, a triple amputee Vietnam vet. I mean, yes. It was like something from Monty Python. Hey, what are you doing? You've still got an arm left. Why didn't you go up there? You know, why didn't you go back? It's sick, but they got away with it. And then they attacked Kerry's military record. Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe he wasn't quite as heroic as said. But he did actually get wounded, and it's silly to argue about, you know, where they weren't serious wounds, you know, and he still had an arm left afterwards. Compare this to George W. Bush.
And he volunteered.
The only fighting that George W. Bush is known to have done in that period was he drove home drunk, knocked over a garbage pail in his home in Washington, and offered his father out. that was over Christmas, the time that we're talking about, in fact. That's the only known battle that George W. Bush has ever been involved in.
That's wonderful. All right, well, thanks for joining us, Ian Williams. Ian Williams, author of Deserter, a review of the military history career of George Bush, fascinating and largely counterfeit thing, just published by Nation Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this topic-appropriate song from the Gang of Four.